Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 433, recorded on Sunday, July 3rd, 2022. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
Today we're talking about American lotteries, which have a lengthy history, despite also being banned for many decades in the middle. Lotteries are a quietly important part of American history, but also symbolize the eventual fusion of Italian urban culture and English settler colonialism, financing the American English colonies from the beginning, and rife with corruption. As always, our sources and notes will be uploaded in a PDF with the episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com, but one source we especially want to recommend, because it is comprehensive in detail of the entire narrative arc and freely available, is the article Lotteries, Revenues, and Social Costs, a Historical Examination of State-Sponsored Gambling by Ronald J. Reichlach in the January 12, 1992 issue of the Boston College Law Review. There's also a decent Britannica article and some useful Wikipedia pages, as well as research by various state governments and associated think tanks. So let's get going on this and look at some of the pre-American history of the lottery so that we understand the roots of this. Rachel, could you talk about this in relation to Italy and the Netherlands, those urban merchant areas of the late Middle Ages and early modern period?
Yeah, so the Netherlands and Italy conducted the first known lotteries. And I guess I didn't realize it, but the kind of modern form of the lottery dates all the way back to the 1400s. The Netherlands in particular use them as a somewhat painless form of town-level taxation. They often use them to raise funds for town fortifications or to help out poor people. A record dated May 9th, 1445 at Le Cluse, or Sluis is the Dutch name, in the Dutch province of Zeeland, refers to raising funds to build walls and town fortifications, with a lottery of 4,304 tickets and a total prize money of 1,737 florins, which is about worth about $170,000 according to 2014 dollar value. This practice continued throughout the centuries, and the Netherlands actually established the oldest running state-level lottery, the Staatsloterij, in 1726. The English word lottery is actually derived from the Dutch noun lot, meaning fate. So one's lot in life is your fate. The first recorded Italian lottery was held on January 9, 1449, in Milan, organized by the Golden Ambrosian Republic to finance the war against the Republic of Venice. However, it was in Genoa that Lotto became very popular. People used to bet on the name of great council members who were drawn by chance, 5 out of 90 candidates every 6 months. This kind of gambling was called Lotto or Semignal. When people wanted to bet more frequently than twice a year, they began to substitute the candidates' names with numbers, and modern Lotto was born, to which both modern legal lotteries and the illegal numbers game, which we'll talk about later, can trace their ancestry. When Italy unified, its first national lottery was established in 1863, with weekly drawings organized for the purpose of providing income to the state. Lotto, the Italian national lottery, is regarded as the basis for such modern gambling games as policy, the numbers game, keno, bingo, and lotto. In England, the first recorded official lottery was chartered by Elizabeth I in 1566, to raise funds for harbor repairs and other public works, and the lottery was drawn in 1569, 3 years later. Each ticket won a prize, and the total value of the prizes was equal to the money raised, so it essentially acted as an interest-free loan to the government with a 3-year term. Each ticket was half a pound, which was about 3 weeks of wages for ordinary citizens, and there were 400,000 tickets issued. Prizes were in the form of quote-unquote ready money or valuable commodities, such as linen cloth, silver plate, or tapestries. Each ticket also granted immunity from one arrest, interestingly enough.
Get-out-of-jail-free card.
Exactly. Quote, so long as a crime wasn't piracy, murder, felonies, or treason, end quote. So basically, I guess, a misdemeanor, you could get out of jail free. But if it were a much more serious crime, you couldn't have that immunity. Many private lotteries were also held. For example, the Virginia Company of London ran a series of lotteries with permission from King James I to fund the settlement of Jamestown. These lotteries ran from 1612 to 1621 when they were banned by the House of Commons. And by 1621, the lotteries comprised a full half of the income of the company. So it was a pretty major fundraising mechanism. The English State Lottery ran from 1694 to 1826. And I'm quoting from the Britannica article. Some important problems developed in the manner of conducting lotteries in England in the 17th and 18th centuries. For most of that period, lotteries were the only form of organized gambling available to the people. They were intensively advertised by such promotions as torchlight processions in the streets. Contractors would often manage to purchase tickets at less than the standard prices for subsequent resale at excessive markups, and a type of side bet called insurance, a small wager that a ticket would or would not be drawn in the regular lottery, was popularized. The state could not derive revenues from either of the latter two practices, but dishonest private operators could. Also, it was claimed that lotteries encouraged mass gambling and that drawings were fraudulent. Their abuses strengthened the arguments of those in opposition to lotteries and weakened their defenders. But before they were outlawed in 1826, the government and licensed promoters had used lotteries for all or portions of the financing of such projects as the building of the British Museum, the repair of bridges, and many projects in the American colonies, such as supplying a battery of guns for the defense of Philadelphia and rebuilding Faneuil Hall in Boston.
Yeah, so as Rachel has just mentioned, this was an important revenue stream for the colonies in the United States, the English colonies specifically. So I want to talk more about that. And obviously, that goes right back to the beginning, because as Rachel said, the Virginia Company was raising a huge amount of its revenue from lotteries being conducted in England. But let's zoom in and talk about the lotteries in the colonies themselves, as opposed to the lotteries that were helping to fund the colonies but being run in England. So beyond the lotteries in England raising funds to establish colonies in the Americas, those colonies quickly found themselves in need of significant funding sources, but without much internal taxing authority or the political support for what few taxes they could raise. Lotteries once again became an easy, voluntary form of taxation, at least until the authorities back in England started growing concerned about this independent local revenue source they hadn't signed off on. Quoting now from the Wikipedia for lottery, lotteries in colonial America played a significant part in the financing of both private and public ventures. It has been recorded that more than 200 lotteries were sanctioned between 1744 and 1776 and played a major role in financing roads, libraries, churches, colleges, canals, bridges, etc. In the 1740s, the foundation of Princeton and Columbia University was financed by lotteries, as well as the University of Pennsylvania by the Academy Lottery in 1755. During the French and Indian Wars, several colonies used lotteries to help finance fortifications and their local militia. In May 1758, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts raised money with a lottery for the expedition against Canada. Benjamin Franklin organized a lottery to raise money to purchase cannons for the defense of Philadelphia. Several of these lotteries offered prizes in the form of pieces of eight, end quote. So, talking now specifically about that fundraising effort related to the French and Indian War, which was also the Seven Years' War in Europe, although it was not generally regarded in that way on the colonial side. To quote from a ticket from Massachusetts, Massachusetts Lottery Number 1, May 1758. The possessor of this ticket, number 8081, shall be entitled to any prize drawn against said number in a lottery granted by an act of the General Court of the province aforesaid passed in April 1758. Towards supplying the treasury with a sum of money for the intended expedition against Canada, subject to no deduction. End quote. The war did ultimately result in the British acquiring Canada from the French. Now, as a side note, but an important one, I want to go back to a point that Rachel mentioned earlier about the etymology of lottery and lot, and especially in American English, not just English English. So Rachel already mentioned the one's lot in life and the idea of fate and so forth, and that is, you know, the English Channel, Germanic, both in England and the Dutch side of things. But let's talk about American English. So the etymology of the American English word lot, meaning specifically a parcel of land, is directly from the concept of a lottery. The idea from the 1630s, early in the American English colonies, is that the parcel is a winning share of land handed down by fate or God to the settlers, usually quite literally distributed at random by the colonial authorities, if it was desirable land at the formation of a new town or settlement area. As I said, it's the same idea as conveyed in the phrase one's lot in life, which had medieval origins, but instead in American English came to refer specifically to physical land. And that is from etimonline.com. We have a great article about this. In many cases, these desirable lots would have been the abandoned farmlands of indigenous communities who had died of earlier waves of European diseases introduced to the Americas nearly a century and a half earlier. In other cases, the lots would have been seized indigenous lands. Settlers would pay to enter their names in a drawing for their share to be distributed by the central authority. As the colonies and eventually the United States expanded, land purchases by private citizens from the government were done by auction instead of lottery, or just outright regular payment if there was no competition for a tract. So again, there's a lot of supply and demand issues going on here, and the idea of a lottery is that everyone pays in equally and gets a lot, whereas, and that's drawn by at random, whereas an auction obviously favors people with more money and more resources rather than it being an equitable means of distributing unequal plots of land at random. And as I said, you know, as you move into the more and more sparsely populated areas with less access to, you know, infrastructure or even rivers, navigable rivers, or you move into areas that are just seen as kind of being, you know, potentially useful for logging or something like that, but they're not really going to be, there's not going to be an enormous amount of competition for it. You can just sell that outright if you're the government. Later lotteries in the colonial period were not for fair distribution of land to all who entered, but were instead simply to raise funding for projects, as we've talked about. And land was used, along with slaves, as a possible prize for a small number of lucky winners, rather than the lottery being specifically to distribute land. Alexander Hamilton noted that participants seemed to prefer a small chance of a large prize over a high chance of a small prize. Those are sort of the two, like, basic polarities or ends of the spectrum when you're running a lottery. Is everyone paying in to have a good shot at getting a small prize, or are they paying in for a long shot for a big prize? And you can choose how you want to structure it. And there's various advantages and disadvantages. But Hamilton's essay basically pointed out that it seemed like people preferred to have the long shot for a big prize, and that was more likely to raise revenue if that was your objective. The Puritans in New England developed an unusually convoluted view that lotteries were biblically acceptable for serious public functions, but not for entertainment or game purposes. So it was okay for distributing land and raising funds for infrastructure and churches. Quakers in Pennsylvania were even more unhappy with lotteries, but they too simply imposed strict regulations on them. So as you can tell, this was a pretty huge feature of life in the American colonies prior to the Revolutionary period. However, once the Revolution kicks off and the Declaration of Independence is signed and so forth, the Continental Congress tried to launch a national lottery as early as 1776. This was not very successful, however, but the governments of individual states followed not long after, and there was once again a big proliferation of public state lotteries. Lotteries in the early United States also played a key role in the development of the more traditional finance sector, and I'm quoting now from that history article in the BC Law Review. Many local lottery promotions had difficulty after the Revolutionary War, but the lottery business expanded rapidly by moving from local operations to state or nationwide productions. Ticket brokers emerged, buying large blocks of tickets at a discount and reselling them throughout the country for a profit. Brokers heavily promoted the lotteries with newspaper advertisements and handbills. They sold tickets on the installment plan, sold fractions of tickets, and sometimes illegally sold out-of-state lottery tickets. In fact, brokers ultimately had complete control of and supervision over lotteries for the sponsoring parties. Colonial period licensing laws were unable to control the problems created by national brokerage, so states had to enact new regulations, which often included bonding and supervision of receipts. In time, brokers established interstate connections, merged, and a few companies were able to monopolize the market. Lottery ticket brokerage became America's first national marketing enterprise and one of the first entities to use the telegraph. Much later, certain lottery brokerage houses moved into stocks and currency exchanges, ultimately evolving into banking enterprises, some of which remain prominent today. Now, eventually, the article sort of suggests that this association with unpopular bankers, especially after the Panic of 1837, began to compound a growing political movement against lotteries. But as Rachel is about to talk about, this was a very multifaceted political movement that included a lot of different dimensions and considerations for or against the lottery. So, Rachel, could you tell us about the growing push in the early 19th century in the United States to get rid of lotteries?
Yeah. This next section is coming from Herbert J. Hovenkamp's article, The Classical American State and the Regulation of Morals, published in 2013 by the Faculty Scholarship at Penn Law Journal. So starting in the 1820s, as another religious revival against vices got underway in the U.S., and concurrently, an abolition of lotteries was happening in Britain, there was a wave of anti-lottery laws, court cases, and state constitutional conventions. So the Jacksonian era of the 1820s was marked by the state acting as a conservative moral regulator at the same time as markets were being liberalized. Quoting from the article, "The great reform movements of the four decades before the Civil War were religiously motivated, heavily Jacksonian or Whig. Their goal was the enactment of civil legislation not associated with any denomination in particular, but with Christian values in general. These laws restricted work or business on Sunday, manufacturing or consumption of alcoholic beverages, gambling and lotteries, etc." So starting in New York, there was a wave of state laws banning lotteries. So New York adopted an anti-lottery statute in 1821, and a stronger one in 1833, followed by Connecticut and Virginia in 1834. And Virginia actually kicked off the first Supreme Court cases talking about lotteries. So the first Supreme Court decision upholding a statute forbidding lotteries came in a dispute challenging a prior state policy of encouraging them. In 1829, the Virginia legislature had authorized a corporation to use a lottery to finance a turnpike, but in 1834 it passed another statute condemning lotteries, but permitting previously approved lotteries to continue until 1837. The company then challenged the limitation as an impairment of a pre-existing contract, and the court found that there was no impairment. By 1860, only three states had not banned lotteries, and they all happened to be three of the four border states in the coming Civil War: Delaware, Kentucky, and Missouri. However, many states, especially in the South, temporarily relaxed their bans on lotteries after the Civil War in order to quickly raise funds to repair the damage brought by the war. These tickets were often sold across state lines, which proved to be very controversial as the bans returned following the Reconstruction period. This caused a harsh U.S. Supreme Court opinion in 1878. Anthony Comstock, infamous for his moral zealotry while acting as a special agent of the post office, arrested dozens of people for circulating lottery materials in the mail. One such dealer, A. Orlando Jackson, protested that his First Amendment rights to free speech were curtailed by Comstock. The Supreme Court decided in ex parte Jackson that the postal ban on lottery materials did not violate the First Amendment right to free expression, but it did state that mail searches required a warrant. Post this decision, more states passed anti-lottery laws. Eventually, the U.S. passed a federal ban on interstate lottery commerce in 1890, and by that point, only Louisiana and Delaware even still allowed lotteries, and states were sick of Louisiana drumming up sales across state lines. Within a few years, that interstate ticket ban dried up the vast majority of sales, and eventually that shut down too. An 1893 Library of Congress report stated that there was a, quote, "a general public conviction that lotteries are to be regarded in direct proportion to their extension as among the most dangerous and prolific sources of human misery," end quote. The ban on interstate lottery commerce was upheld by the Supreme Court decision in Champion v. Ames in 1903, when Champion was indicted for transporting Paraguayan lottery tickets from Texas to California. The decision stated that interstate commerce regulatory powers extended up to prohibition of interstate commerce of items, not just regulation.
Yeah, so sort of an interesting movement here that leads to quite a long ban in state lottery tickets being available, let alone sold across state lines. And one of the things that was raised in the BC Law Review article about the history of this is that it became a lot easier for the moral dimension and arguments and the religious case against lotteries to come to the fore once there were other sources of revenue. And I think that's, you know, as we're presenting the materialist history here on this, it's important to underscore that, right? That if you can come up with other sources of revenues, you're going to probably be less likely to have a lottery. If that becomes difficult, then it's going to be a lot easier to brush aside the sort of moral arguments and religious arguments on this. And I think we're going to see that reflected again when we come back to the revival era of the lotteries. But as things became, as other revenue collection methods came to the fore in the early 19th century United States, there was less pressure to maintain the lotteries. And so you could actually have a real debate on that. And I just want to make that important point because it's easy to say, oh, there was this big religious push on various issues. And that's true. But that stuff seems to only really prevail if there's not a countervailing materialist case of the urgency of maintaining that particular vice being available. So as Rachel said, by the 1890s, lotteries are gone in the United States, at least the official public ones. There was a long gap between state lotteries from this period of the 1890s when Louisiana finally ended theirs until 1964. During this interim, however, lotteries obviously continued, but they were illegal and they were privately run by organized crime. And this was generally most commonly known as the numbers game or the numbers racket or simply the Italian lottery, obviously going back to what we've already talked about with the history in the Italian cities and the 19th century. Unfortunately, this was also known by a name that we won't repeat here because it includes a slur that reflects the popularity of the game among northeastern urban working-class black residents. So let's talk about the numbers game because this is going to be really important not only for that interim period but also for the period that follows with the revival of state lotteries. The mechanism in the numbers game, utilized by a wide range of organized crime outfits during this period, was no longer a random drawing but a game of paying to guess a number. And then if that number is selected, the person wins a prize. And so, again, this goes back to what Rachel already talked about in cities like Genoa and so forth, where they had been doing this kind of thing for a long time. In Italy, you make various bets on things that are going to happen or just random numbers. And then if you get your number picked, then you win a prize. And to keep the winning numbers random and to avoid the problem of a rigged drawing of numbered balls from a spinning machine, the winning numbers would eventually often be drawn from some number combination that regularly appeared in the newspaper, such as closing numbers of a stock market index or U.S. Treasury reports or the results of horse race betting, although the latter quickly also became subject to rigging to control the outcome of the numbers game. The numbers games in the U.S. dated back to the pre-Civil War period, but they were illegal and they were not used by state lotteries in the 19th century. Operating a numbers game in a 20th century American city for an organized crime enterprise was a very labor-intensive process and encompassed various physical territory that could be contested by rival outfits. Bettors were playing daily, and their bets and selected numbers had to be collected from all over the place by bookies and runners, with winnings circulated back each day as well. The number of people that had to be involved to run one, as well as relatively proportional large prizes if someone actually guessed the right number combination, meant the margins were often, although not always, actually kind of low in some cases, at least compared to what you might expect. In really big cities like New York, there were dozens and dozens of illegal lotteries being operated daily in the peak years, many covering quite small turfs of just a few blocks, while others covered every neighborhood of the same ethnicity in a whole borough, or even the entire metro region. When states began exploring reviving legal, publicly controlled lotteries in the 1960s, beginning with New Hampshire and then New York, they typically devised a legalized version of the numbers game and random number generators, since it was clearly a popular form of gambling, and they thought that it could undermine organized crime's revenues by reducing the illegal market. That illegal market actually did not evaporate immediately, however, since some of the early lotteries that were legal weren't all that appealing in terms of the payouts. Additionally, the U.S. federal government did not lift the ban on advertising to promote lotteries until 1975, which is, you know, a huge impediment, as we'll talk about later, with regard to getting people to switch from illegal lotteries to legal lotteries. So after, in like the late 1970s is when the legal lotteries really take off after about a decade or so of experimentation. Some types of lotteries are still prohibited today by state laws, but they happen anyway illegally. But as I said, most of the legal ones are numbers games, or there's various other things like Keno, and you know, you all know what we're talking about here. There are also still laws governing the use of the postal service with regard to lotteries, and smuggling does occur. And that is a callback to the Comstock era. Today, 45 states, District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands have their own official lotteries, while five states do not. There are two joint interstate lotteries, Powerball and Mega Millions, operating in all of these same places, and there are also several other interstate lotteries that are only in some states, like regional ones, but there is not any official federal lottery. Nevada does not have a lottery because it would be in competition with their actual physical casinos, and some states still have religiously driven bans. I'm not completely sure what's going on with Alaska and Hawaii. I have some ideas, but I'm not going to speculate. Revenues and participation have generally actually been on the decline in the 21st century, especially as casinos have proliferated, although there are other factors cited in the decline. And I'm going to be quoting now here from an NCSL.org article. That's the National Conference of State Legislatures, which is sort of acts like a think tank for policy research and that kind of thing between states. So they say on average, about 1% of state revenue comes from lotteries, so not really a huge amount. Nationally, state lotteries generated $66.8 billion in gross revenue in fiscal 2015, which exceeds the $48.7 billion generated by corporate income taxes. So there's actually more money brought in by lottery players than corporate income taxes. However, after putting $42.2 billion of that income into prizes, so again, that's a pretty significant amount proportionally, and then also $3.2 billion into administration and advertising, states were left with net lottery proceeds of just $21.4 billion in 2015. Between fiscal 2014 and 2015, 22 states saw their lottery revenue decline. I'm not sure what it's been since then because this was the most recent item that I found on this, but it gives you a general idea of the trend, and that wasn't a one-year, that was one specific one-year statistic, but that was part of a larger trend, as we'll talk about. According to data from the Rockefeller Institute, lottery struggles have been particularly pronounced in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic dating back to fiscal year 2008, while lotteries in the Southeastern and Western regions have tended to experience growth, but lotteries are relatively newer in these regions, especially in the South. End quote. Lotteries have often been defended for raising a bit of dedicated revenue for important programs like education or healthcare. We'll talk more about that in a bit. These supposedly tap into already existing revenue streams that would otherwise be underground and inaccessible to the state, but they also seem to require a strong marketing campaign to gin up participation to maintain those revenues, which raises serious ethical questions with regard to the state relationship to gambling addiction and poverty, and we'll circle back to that shortly. Quoting now from research published by the University of North Texas some years ago, once established, lotteries retain their broad public support. In states with lotteries, 60% of adults report playing at least once a year. In addition to the general public, lotteries also develop extensive specific constituencies, including convenience store operators, the usual vendors for lotteries, lottery suppliers, heavy contributions by suppliers to state political campaigns are regularly reported, teachers in those states in which revenues are earmarked for education, state legislators who quickly become accustomed to the extra revenue, etc. Since New Hampshire initiated the modern era of state lotteries in 1964, no state lottery has been abolished. Critics charge, however, that the program of earmarking of funds is misleading. Lottery proceeds used for a specific program, such as public education, in fact, simply allow the legislature to reduce by the same amount the appropriations it would otherwise have had to allot for that purpose from the general fund. The money saved remains in the general fund to be spent on whatever purpose the legislature chooses. Critics add that as there is little or no evidence that overall funding has increased for the targeted recipients of lottery revenues, the only result has been to increase the discretionary funds available to the legislature, which may be a key reason for the popularity of lotteries in the state houses. End quote. Although, again, worth reminding us that on average, it's 1% or less of the budgets comes from the lottery. So it's raising some amount of money, but it's not raising an enormous amount of money. And we'll talk more about this in a bit. But first, Rachel, I wanted you to talk a little bit about things like taxes on winnings and how these lotteries are paid out in the legal era.
Yeah, so this comes from the taxact.com blog, which is a purveyor of tax products. So the IRS automatically takes 25% off the top. After that, the rest of the earnings are taxed according to the progressive federal tax brackets, with the top bracket taxed at 37%. And then come state and local taxes as applicable. And two states, Arizona and Maryland, actually tax the winning of non-residents. So if you happen to drive through, buy a lotto ticket from those states, and happen to win, you end up owing taxes to those two states as well. Now, as to how to collect the payout, an annuity versus a lump sum, most experts recommend lump sum payouts over annuities because a lump sum can be invested in high return investments that provide more income over time. However, with annuities, your winnings are more likely to be taxed in a lower tax bracket, and you can take advantage of tax deductions year after year. So a lot of the decision-making depends on residency and likely return on those high return investments if you happen to pursue those. As for the disadvantages of these state lotteries, they're actually quite easy to manipulate. And I found a Washington Post article from 2018, titled "Who's Willing to Bet That State Lotteries Are Free of Manipulation?" Quoting from that article, just last year, so that would be 2017, a former executive with the Multi-State Lottery Association pleaded guilty to tampering with software so he could predict the winning numbers drawn in five state lotteries. The scheme enabled him to partner with straw buyers to claim $2.2 million in winnings before he was caught. The scam came to light because Iowa, like most states, requires players to provide their real names when they claim their winnings. When a shell company based in Belize tried to redeem a winning ticket in Iowa, investigators rejected the claim and started investigating the company. That unraveled the conspiracy. In November 2016, a consortium of journalists and researchers from 10 countries published an exhaustive study about state-run gambling and all the ways it can go wrong. Among the conclusions, more than 1,700 people across the United States turn up repeatedly in lottery records as quote-unquote super winners of 50 or more significant prizes, an astronomically improbable rate. The consortium's data gathering led to spin-off investigations across the country. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looked into the backgrounds of frequent prize winners and found that at least three of the 13 players who have won 20 times or more in recent years either worked for lottery retail stores or were closely tied to someone who did. This isn't new. 4 years ago, reporters from the Palm Beach Post used public records from Florida's lottery agency to document a suspicious pattern of repeat prize winners. The most likely explanation? The winning tickets were actually held by people who had stolen them, owed child support, or otherwise couldn't risk being detected, so they sent strawman claimants to pick up the winnings. The 2014 investigation led the Florida Lottery to shut down sales at 18 retailers and implement other safeguards. A similar pattern turned up in Massachusetts. The Boston Globe reported that the practice of paying a commission to frontmen who redeemed tickets for criminals was so commonplace that state lottery officials had coined a name for it, 10%ers.
So we've talked now about the problems with legal lotteries that are the illegal side of legal lotteries, but we need to talk now about if a lottery goes completely according to plan, everything's above board, all on the up and up, what are the ethical problems that are still associated with this? And I will disclose here that as a public official myself, an elected official, I've taken a pretty hostile stance toward lotteries. That's something that I believed before I got elected. I've helped use my position as an elected official to try to halt the expansion of lottery activities into my city and especially into the poorer neighborhoods. And I think that it will become clear why I have this opinion as we go through some of this further material. And, you know, to make the materialist argument against this, I don't think the money that is coming in is worth it, given the costs that are being associated and imposed on our society as a result of this. And I don't think that's like an abstract moral argument, really. I think that's genuinely like, this is not good for our people, and especially our poorer people and our minorities. But let's talk a little bit more about this. So going back to that University of North Texas research, I'm going to quote at some length here about some of their findings, which I think are actually probably, I think this report was maybe probably 20 or 25 years ago at this point. Critics counter, however, that whatever the impact on revenue and illegal gambling may be, the benefits of the lottery are more than offset by its expanding the number of people who are drawn into gambling, basically talking about people who wouldn't otherwise be gambling who are now gambling because of this. Worse, lotteries are alleged to promote addictive gambling behavior, are characterized as a major regressive tax on lower income groups, and are said to lead to other abuses. Even more troubling, however, is the general criticism that the state faces an inherent conflict in its desire to increase revenue and its duty to protect the public welfare. Because the lotteries are run as a business with a focus on maximizing revenues, advertising necessarily focuses on persuading target groups to spend their money on the lottery. The questions are, one, does this promotion of gambling lead to negative consequences for the poor, problem gamblers, etc.? Two, even if these problems are minimal, is this an appropriate function for the state? Is running a lottery at cross purposes with the larger public interest? Critics charge that lottery advertising seeks to stimulate rather than merely accommodate demand, a role for the state that may be inconsistent with other functions of government. Lottery advertisements must either encourage existing players to buy more tickets or entice non-players into becoming players. These and other opponents allege that lottery advertising is targeted to appeal to the irrational elements in the public's imagination, seeking to persuade potential players that they can influence their odds through the choices of the numbers they pick, and also that it attempts to convince the individual player that his chance of winning is far greater than the odds would suggest. In the words of one, lottery play depends on encouraging people's magical thinking, which advertising must target. According to the New Jersey Lottery's director, the purpose of advertising is to take an infrequent user and convert them into a more frequent user. The focus on convincing non-players or infrequent players to utilize the lottery, as well as persuading frequent players to play even more, is the source of an additional array of criticisms. Giving force to this concern is the widespread conception that the lottery is a regressive tax because it draws a disproportionate amount of its revenues from lower income groups. The image of the state promoting a highly regressive scheme among its poorest citizens by playing on their unrealistic hopes is a highly evocative one. The most frequently cited and most egregious example of this was a billboard in one of Chicago's poorest neighborhoods that touted the lottery as how to go from Washington Boulevard to Easy Street, play the Illinois State Lottery. This assumption, however, may not be accurate. Much depends on the definition of regressive. Economists define a regressive tax as one that takes an increasing percentage of income as income falls. In that sense, given that a lottery ticket is the same price to all regardless of income, it is by definition regressive, and it is considered an implicit tax because revenues go to the state. But this simple approach does not capture such variables as frequency of play and the amounts of money generated by the lottery by an income group. Here, the evidence divides by the type of game played. The data suggests, although is far from conclusive, that the bulk of lotto players and revenues come from middle-income neighborhoods, and that far fewer proportionally come from either high-income or low-income areas. Klotfelter and Cook cite one study in the 1970s which concluded that the poor participate in state lottery games at levels disproportionately less than their percentage of the population. By contrast, those playing the daily numbers game, including scratch tickets, are drawn quite heavily from lower income neighborhoods. So there's a little bit of a difference in what exact type you're talking about of game. The popular belief is that the poor are much heavier users of the lottery than the rich and middle classes. However, in fact, although lottery play is systematically related to social class, it is perhaps not as strongly as the conventional wisdom would relate. The data do not demonstrate any consistent relationship between lottery play and household income over the broad middle range. On average, people bet the same amount on the state lottery regardless of income. Absolute expenditures appear to be remarkably uniform over a broad range of incomes. Assuming this is true, though, the lottery may still be termed regressive because the state takes a greater percentage of income from those with lower incomes. Whatever similarity between income groups there may be regarding absolute amounts spent on the lottery, Klotfelter and Cook agree that the poor spend a larger proportion of their incomes on the lottery. Although total expenditures on the lottery may be broadly similar by income group, the type of game they play differs considerably. An analysis by the Chicago Sun-Times revealed that lower-income individuals concentrate much more heavily on the numbers game, trading lower payoffs with a higher chance of winning. They also are likely to be frequent players, often daily players. Lotto, with its big money jackpots and slim odds, appears to appeal to more upper-income groups, most of whom are only occasional players, usually when the prize money reaches large proportions. Klotfelter and Cook report that lottery marketing strategies do seem to explicitly target lower-income groups. For example, the advertising plan for Ohio's Super Lotto game stated that lottery promotions should be timed to coincide with the receipt of government benefits, payroll, and Social Security payments. And as a side note, because I thought this was interesting, there's also one other quirk of legalized lotteries, because usually the discussion is about, well, what would the situation be if it were illegal? Would organized crime be running it and so forth? But there was actually one other kind of lottery that was out there that we didn't really talk about that was competing kind of unofficially very locally this whole time, which was charitable gambling like church bingo nights. And according to this same University of North Texas article, the lottery has also apparently had a negative impact on charitable gambling. In 1984, charitable gaming in Massachusetts, such as church bingo, had revenues of $250 million. By 1995, those figures had declined to $200 million. Competition from the lottery is usually blamed, especially following the introduction of Keno. And then there's a funny quote from a local rabbi who said, "We're getting slaughtered by Keno." Anyway, there's also some other articles and sections that I've put in the notes if people are interested in reading. One is about the fungibility of funds from lotteries. That gets into more about whether or not the money is being spent on the things it's supposedly being spent on in the marketing for why you should have a public lottery. And there is also a longer additional critique of state lotteries from democracyjournal.org that talked about the demographics specifically, gets more into the income issues, the minority participation, the marketing around that, and also, again, emphasizes that this actually isn't raising an enormous amount of revenue, and there are various other options that could be entertained that aren't just illegal lotteries being run by organized crime, but, for example, strengthening those charitable lotteries, not just local ones. You could potentially have large-scale charitable lotteries, and that would at least be raising money that would be going to stuff that otherwise wouldn't be getting funding regardless, as opposed to the legislature where they're just playing a shell game and moving the money around. But without getting too far off track on that, I want to go back to you, Rachel, before we wrap this up. We've obviously talked about this long historical arc and ebb and flow of the lotteries, but what were your thoughts about this and these sort of ethical questions that are raised? Because that's obviously been something that I feel very strongly about, but I understand a lot of people feel like that's sort of a paternalistic nanny state view. Although, again, I think there is a difference between saying something is legal or illegal versus we're actively running this as a state enterprise and very heavily promoting it with advertising and marketing.
Yeah, I really agree with you on the fact that it is targeting these lower income populations and just really immiserating them for very little gain. So I think from a moral standpoint, whether religious or not, the fact that it is targeting these minority populations, these lower income populations, it's immoral on its face. And the fact that we're not even getting that much out of it just kind of underlines that fact that we're not even gaining anything from this immoral practice. And also you brought up the point that state legislatures just cut the funding from these programs, that the lottery funds. So in Idaho, education is funded through our state lottery, and we are also one of the least funded states for education. So it's not great, obviously. So the fact that we're not even funding education, which is the ostensible goal, it's another point in the column of getting rid of it. However, I might be persuaded if we go back to raffling off get out of free jail cards. That would be a very attractive prize, I'm sure. So maybe we should go back to that, or I agree, like, charitable gambling is a more fun, less terrible way to raise money for, like, private goals. So I think, like, the private gambling is more on a, unless shaky, moral ground versus these state-run lotteries.
I think, as with many other, whether you want to call them vices or just things that are have social ill consequences, things that are, from a materialist standpoint, bad for a lot of vulnerable people, marketing and advertising has to be taken into account here, right? There are other countries that have much stricter regulations on marketing and advertising, not just for things like lotteries, but also for, you know, prescription drugs or various other things that can potentially hurt you and so forth. And those societies are better off, and their vulnerable populations specifically are better off. And I don't even think that's a moral argument, really. I think that's a materialist argument. And you could have still legalized or private charitable lotteries that are run in a different way with less aggressive advertising and marketing that is less attuned to hoovering up those problem gamblers, those repeat gamblers, and preying on them. You could still have some benefits and reduce the role of organized crime and so forth without what I would consider to be a very deleterious policy that states are involving themselves in by taking on this public role and aggressively pushing it forward. And also not just not being honest about, you know, what they're doing with it and what the consequences are. But I think it's not a mistake either that this stuff comes back after a lengthy period of being banned around the time that the wheels start coming off the American prosperity economy and you start shifting into the neoliberal mode of getting blood from the stone and not really raising public revenues through taxation, especially of corporations and the wealthy. This becomes, again, socially acceptable in the way that it had been in the early 19th century. The last thing I wanted to say is, I don't know about you, but I didn't realize the way that this was so inextricably bound up in the, like, American settler colonial project, especially with regard to the distribution of land. And I had never really thought about why lots of land are called that in American English.
Yeah, that's something that stood out to me as well. I do know that there was a very controlled spread of settlers across, like, the East. And I think there was a project to keep it restricted. So I think looking at it from knowing that, it makes more sense that you would really control who gets the land and how much land gets distributed at a time. So to have those restrictions on the spread of settlers and kind of that westward expansion, because I know that a lot of the founding fathers really were against moving west in an uncontrolled, rapid manner. So it does kind of make sense to that there would be these lotteries to apportion it in a more controlled way.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you for being on the show this week to talk about state lotteries in the United States and its role in American history.
Glad to be here. It was a fascinating subject.